and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, or even just doesn't know it exists, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is Philippe Sildean. Philippe, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, tell us what you have come on the show to talk about. Give us some context around its development, release, reception, why it is maligned, and why you think that that is wrong.
Right. I have chosen The Matrix Reloaded. It's the second movie in The Matrix trilogy. It was released in 2003, and it's made by the Wachowskis. It's a sequel to the 1999 movie The Matrix, who was extremely popular and still today is wildly acclaimed. And it was followed by The Matrix Revolutions, which was released 6 months later. And it was produced together with that movie. When it came out, people were underwhelmed, as I understand it. I was still too young to have seen it in cinemas. But the general consensus was that it wasn't quite as good as Matrix, and then it has now sort of dissolved into, well, most people, when they talk about the Matrix sequels, they actually say, what Matrix sequels?
Yes, that's true.
And so many people doesn't seem to be aware that this exists, and I like this movie a lot. And I like it mainly because it's such a different movie from the first Matrix. Because the first Matrix is about, well, struggle against power. It's a very, has a very desperate tone. They're constantly on the run. They're trying to figure it out as they go along, especially as you see this through Neo's eyes. And at the end of the first movie, he realizes all his powers. He can now stop bullets in midair. He can fly. He becomes essentially Superman. And they even joke about it in the second movie. And so what I think is amazing about Reloaded is that they didn't nerf him. They didn't, okay, you know, we're going to bring him back down to Earth. No, they said, no, we gave him all this power. We're going to let him use it and still challenge him. So Reloaded is very different from the first movie because this is essentially a Superman movie.
It kind of is, yeah. It is very different to the first one, isn't it? I'm interested that you didn't, you say you were too young to see it in cinema, so presumably you hadn't seen the original Matrix in the cinema either.
No, I haven't seen any of them in the cinema. I would have been 7. I was born 92 when the first one came out. And, you know, these are violent movies.
That's true.
with deaths and sex and everything, so I first heard of it like in, I think, middle school, where people were talking about it. And yeah, eventually I got to see it with my dad.
Right. So you saw them. So you've seen them all on home video, essentially.
Yes, essentially.
Wow. So that's interesting because a lot of the first Matrix, talking about the first movie for a while, a lot of the impact of that was, you know, was from the buzz that people got seeing it in the cinema. You know, the big screen always helps with a big sort of spectacle action movie. Seeing it on the massive screen always gives it more impact. But also because it was so new and different at the time that I think that kind of magnified the effects of seeing it on the big screen. You know, when people saw it in the cinema, they were literally seeing something that had never been seen before. You know, except for give or take a few days, you know, of it being on release. Whereas by the time it came out on home video, other movies had already started imitating The Matrix by that point.
Right.
And it led to a spawn of imitators. So I'm fascinated that it had such an impact on you seeing it, you know, sort of years afterwards when the visual language of The Matrix had become mainstream almost.
Commonplace. Yeah, it's the same feeling I got when my dad showed me 2001. And by that time, I had already, I guess, seen 5 or 6 movies where the AI turns evil and everything. And I had played Mass Effect 2, which I think is the perfect AI on a ship story, because they take everything, they subvert it, they made it perfect. So I could appreciate 2001, you know, in a historical context, but of course it didn't blow me away the same way it would seen it new. And I think it was the same with the original Matrix.
But you did enjoy it, and obviously enough to then seek out, presumably, this second movie.
Yes, I think when people talked about it in school, they were mainly talking, I mean, these were young kids, so they were excited about the big, the burly brawl from the second movie where Neo fights, you know, 100 guys at the same time. And so for me, as I had understood Matrix from the guys at school, that scene was the essence of Matrix. And then I watched it and realized that, oh, okay, that's actually not the case. This is a, you know, this is a movie that makes you think. I think that was the first movie that made me think in that way, both Matrix and then Reloaded.
And Reloaded is a lot heavier on the sort of philosophy and the world building compared to the first movie, which is why a lot of people didn't like it, because you said it was, you know, very different to the first movie. And that is why, I mean, you know, this is one of those cases where people can argue that, you know, this movie was very successful, very financially successful. I saw on its Wikipedia page something like about 46 million tickets were sold in the United States to see this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's enormously popular. But it is true that this and Revolutions are generally maligned, especially by people who loved the first movie, because they're so different.
They're so different, yeah. And part of that, I think, why I like this movie is I love world building, and I like this. I like introducing these new characters. It's one of the reasons that I also like The Phantom Menace, because it does world building so well, in my opinion. The other Star Wars prequels, you know, their world building goes a bit astray, but The Phantom Menace still holds up in that department.
Wow. Okay. Controversial.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm not saying it's a good movie. I'm not saying it's a good Star Wars movie. All right.
We've already done Phantom Menace on this show.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. That's what got me into your show. I was like, oh, someone's defending them.
Oh, excellent.
I'm not saying they're good movies. I'm saying I think the Phantom Menace does world building pretty well.
I mean, I didn't. This is the. I watched this movie in preparation for the show, obviously, and it was the first time I'd seen it. Because I did see the first Matrix in the cinema, and I was blown away by it at the time. You know, sort of by the effects anyway. In terms of the story, I wasn't quite as blown away as some people, because the first Matrix has, you know, draws heavily on certain ideas of Gnosticism and, you know, the hallucinatory nature of reality and stuff that I had read about already and sort of been exposed to in sometimes graphic novels, but also literature and fiction and stuff. So that part of it didn't quite blow me away the way it did some people. But nevertheless, I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it a lot. But I kind of felt like it stood on its own. When they said they were doing sequels, I was like, really? Really? But, you know, I had an open mind until... I'd forgotten about this until I started sort of making notes for this. It was at, I believe, the Bristol Comics Festival in 2003 when this movie was released. I was there with a whole bunch of, you know, friends, other comics colleagues and fans and what have you. And one friend loved the first movie so much that he named his daughter Trinity.
Oh, wow.
That's how much of a fan he was. He and his wife called their daughter Trinity.
But Trinity's not a bad name, though.
Oh, no, I mean, it's a great name regardless. Exactly. But that is why they called her Trinity.
Right.
And they, because they loved it so much, and the movie, this, Reloaded, was released the weekend of the Comics Festival, as I recall. So they took the Friday night, while we were all, you know, having dinner and drinking in the bar, they went to the cinema, to the local cinema, to see this movie. And I will never forget their faces when they came back. They were ashen faced. Just, I mean, they are the perfect example of what you were saying earlier, of like some people kind of jokingly half-jokingly say, oh, there were no Matrix sequels.
This movie doesn't exist.
Exactly. And that's, and so, because they had loved it so much, I was like, well, if they didn't like it, I'm not going to go and see it.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's a bit unfair that they get that treatment, like, because I don't think there is anything in this. You're right. It maybe this movie doesn't need to exist. Like, The Matrix stood on its own. But I think that the sequels, at least story-wise, in the terms of overarching story, don't ruin the first movie. Some movies do that. I saw a movie recently, Now You See Me, and it had a sequel, Now You See Me Too. And that is a case of where the sequel completely ruins the first movie when you follow the plot.
Oh, right. The story actually undermines the first.
Yes, completely. The first movie after. So that's a case of, okay, I will pretend that the sequel doesn't exist so I can still enjoy the first quite good movie. I don't feel like that's the case here. I feel like it expands the world, but without undermining the first movie.
Okay, interesting. So, I mean, like I say, I hadn't seen it before, and I still haven't seen Revolutions.
Right.
I did find it. I found it really slow. I was surprised, like really surprised, at how little action there is in it, given that the first movie was pretty much all action, you know.
All the time, yeah.
Yeah, apart from sitting in front of a computer and going, Unix, I know this. It was just, you know, fight after fight, and the action sequences is what people remember it for. And then I was amazed that like 40 minutes into this movie before we get that big playground fight with all the 100 Agent Smiths.
Yes, but that's following the theme of this movie, and again, coming back to Superman. It's not interesting watching Superman fight because you know he will win. In this movie, Neo wins every single fight. And, you know, there is that fight when he fights all the 100 Smith, but I don't see him losing that fight. That is the same as losing a fight against the incoming tide. Like, you're gonna drown. But every time he fights, he wins. And so I think it was good of them to actually scale back the fighting or move it to when you have the big motorway sequence or the highway sequence. You move the action instead to Trinity and Morpheus, two people who now actually can lose. But since he can't lose, they cut back on the fighting so that you don't get too many uninteresting fights.
Yeah, and that's a kind of classic storyteller's dilemma in that to do that, to put Morpheus and Trinity in danger, they have to essentially put Neo in a box.
Right. In a quite literal box, yeah.
Yeah, where he doesn't even know they're in danger. Because otherwise, as you say, he'd just fly in and, you know, sort of just make everything fine again.
Right. But I think that's also very good because they could have started this movie with the same green screen as the first one where they say, you know, tracking. They could have said, Matrix version 7.02, fixed the chosen one bug. And then when you start the movie and Neo doesn't have any powers, and then it would basically be the same movie all over again. And Hollywood is very fond of doing that. And so I think it was really brave of them to actually know he keeps his power. And we're not going to introduce any kryptonite. He never, in this movie, gets weaker. They bring in some aliens, but still, he beats them. These are people who can actually, you know, put up a challenge, but he still wins. So they make, okay, how do we challenge Neo? Okay, we create a solution where he can't punch his way out of the problem. And so they make it, okay, he has to find information. He has to gain a knowledge. And that's the way they challenge him in a movie where he can win a fight. And I think that's very good, instead of bringing in something that can weaken him. Or as they do in the third movie, they bring Smith up to his level.
Spoilers.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, I'm joking. I don't care. Hello, everyone. Sorry to interrupt this wonderful discussion of Matrix Reloaded, but this is the time of year when we remind you about how you can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. You can do that by signing up for a monthly or annual pledge to support the show and the network directly. All you have to do is go to theincomparable.com/members. That's theincomparable.com/members and sign up. You'll then be asked to pick the shows on the network that you would like to support. And if you just check the box for unjustly maligned, your entire contribution will come to us after admin fees for the network, obviously. Also, if you do listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, you can check their boxes as well. And if you do that, then your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows that you want to support. And members don't just get a warm glow from knowing that they're helping their favourite shows stay on the air. No, they also get an exclusive members-only audio feed with extra stuff to listen to, access to an unedited so-called bootleg feed of The Incomparable. There's a members-only Slack and other random cool stuff, such as, because this is pledge season this month, many shows on the network are posting bonus episodes created just for members. For example, I'm putting together a special Unjustly Maligned episode where listeners can defend something of their choice. I'll answer questions from members and maybe some other stuff that will be a surprise. And that episode will only be available to members. It will never go on general release. Members can pledge $5, $10 or $20 per month, and annual equivalents are also available. And if you're already a member, it's now also very easy to increase your pledge to a higher level and get even more special goodies in return. So if you'd like to support the show and the network, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up right now. Thank you very much. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I don't think that Revolutions, despite it being produced at the same time, I think that Revolutions is a much worse film than this and the first Matrix.
It is very, I mean, you're right that it's a kind of Superman-like problem or way of solving that problem where you're right. So, you know, this is one of the constant, eternal dilemmas with writing Superman and characters like him is that he's kind of boring because you know he's not going to lose.
Because he wins.
Yeah, and he can do practically anything. And so, yes, the eternal sort of solution to that, in comic books especially, has been to present Superman with a problem that, as you say, he can't solve by punching it. He can't win just by fighting it. He has to use his brain. And so that was definitely brave, as you say, of them to not hit a reset button and not depower him. And if anything, he actually gets more powerful in this movie.
Right, yes.
Because he brings his powers somehow back into the real world, it would seem.
Yes, right at the end. That has been sort of the subject of a lot of debate, like how can he do that? And there is the Matrix within a Matrix theory that Zion as well, the quote-unquote real world, is another version of the Matrix, and therefore his powers manifest there as well. I don't subscribe to that. I think more like he carries this code, and I believe that that sort of empowers him against the machines more than anything else. Because he can't manifest any of his other powers. He can't, you know, jump really high. He can't fight that good in the real world. He can only basically control the machines. So that I feel like that limits the sort of Matrix within a Matrix theory.
Yeah, that would make sense, absolutely. I hadn't really given it that much thought, but now that you've said that, yeah, that's, you know, at first blush, I'll go along with that.
Yeah.
The one thing I will say is that I don't think it benefits particularly well from the passage of time, much like the original Matrix. Like, if the original Matrix now is like the bullet time stuff is so primitive.
Right, yes.
You know, compared to what we can do now, that it is kind of, you know, you have to adopt a sort of nostalgic way of watching it almost. It's like reading a Gibson cyberpunk novel from the 1980s, which I do. I regularly read. I love Gibson's work. I regularly reread the Sprawl trilogy. But you have to kind of adopt a certain nostalgic mindset when you do so, because so much of it has become mainstream.
So dated, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of the references feel dated. And obviously real world technology has overtaken the sort of stuff Gibson was writing about. Whereas in this, it's more a case of CG now has become so good, so amazing, that, and compositing as well, that what seemed at the time, these incredible, unreal amazing
feats,
you know, never before seen, yeah, feats of, you know, camera trickery and stuff. It's just kind of,
we see it everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The CGI doesn't hold up, especially when he fights all those Smiths and they go into full CGI mode. That doesn't hold up at all. But in the other way, this movie is also timeless in a different way from Matrix, because in the original Matrix, you have all these, you know, old computers, you know, the technology is very old as compared, but the Matrix, the world of the Matrix in this movie, the technology could still be used today, almost the most of it, at least.
Most of it, yeah, although those giant cell phones that they carry around.
But I can sort of accept that. Okay, in order to, you know, talk from the way out of this program, they need massive, you know, cell phones.
Sure, sort of a military hardware style phones almost.
Yeah, exactly. They need something like it to reach out of the Matrix.
But yeah, the I knew when this came out, I was working for a movie and DVD review magazine. So even though I hadn't seen it, you know, I had all the,
you had read PR about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I knew that, the Burly Brawl, the chock full of Hugos thing, that it went full CG at times. What I didn't realize until watching it this time was how long those sequences are.
Yeah.
Like they are full 30 second plus, you know, sequences in that fight, which you can tell if you know what to look for, you can tell are just pure CG. I had no idea that they went on for that long.
Yeah, it is amazing. And the same thing where Neo is actually flying on the highway sequence, where the buses or the trucks collide and you see him flying across. That is an entire CG city.
Yes.
That took months to make, apparently. And yeah, so for something that takes, you know, 10 seconds and could have been, you know, they could have just put Chicago and then made the custom highway. So they clearly wanted to show off.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, it's a little easier to justify them, actually, because they built the highway as well, famously,
right, yes,
on Alameda Airfield. But it's a little easier to justify that because that's a full 15 minutes right in the center of the film.
Yes.
So that's obviously a huge thing. Whereas, as you say, building a CG city that'll only be seen for 10 seconds is, yeah, not so much. But it's I was also wondering about the CG. If, like, when you first watched it, and bearing in mind you were watching on home video, obviously not a big screen, but
yes,
when you first watched it, were you fooled, as it were, or did you immediately recognize that you were watching full CG sequences? And I'm thinking also, speaking of the highway chase, of that shot of the agent leaping from car to car.
Right. I think I realized it with the agent, because I think that the cars, something there with the physics didn't totally make sense to me, to my brain. So my brain was, okay, that's different. I don't remember thinking, but I was not old at the time, but I don't remember the Burly Brawl when he fights all those Mr. Smith. I don't remember thinking, oh, that's CG. I think I was just so into it at that point. You know, the cool center of my brain had overloaded the rest of it. And also bear in mind, this movie has some pacing issues. There's like a conversation and then action, a conversation and then action, exposition and then action. And what happens is that during the action, you have time to digest what has been said. So you're still a bit reeling from the conversation with the Oracle and Mr. Smith right before that Burly Brawl scene. And I think that also helps in that you're somehow distracted because you're still thinking, okay, the Oracle is a program. Hang on here. And Mr. Smith is free and can copy himself. All these implications are sinking into your mind at the same time as you're watching. So I don't think I realized the first time that I was looking at CG.
Right. And talking about the pacing, yeah, I mean, that's, I don't think the pacing in this movie is particularly good. It's very long for a start. But also, as you said, there is a tendency to have lots of talking and then 5 minutes of action and then lots more talking and then another 5 minutes of action.
Yeah.
And it's,
That's one of the movie's flaws. I will admit that.
It just seems to... I mean, there is a lot of talking. As we said, it's a very different movie to the first one. There's a lot of talking going on. And then, yeah, it's almost like, okay, everything stops now. Let's have a fight.
Right. Yeah, that's very true. Now, the pacing and that, you know, dividing up into talking scenes and fighting scenes, that is very true, and that's one of the problems with this movie, I feel. But also, I like the fact that you can have these long, interesting conversations. That's another thing that I really like in movies. You know, intelligent people having intelligent conversation, that's pretty rare.
That's true.
and that comes to its culmination in the architect scene, where they, you know, drop all this information at you in a very short period of time, and it's sort of punctured. Every sentence is almost punctured by Trinity fighting this agent.
Yeah, that was when I mentioned that I was watching this. A friend said, "Oh, there's a point where the movie just stops. You'll know it when you see it." And I'm guessing that he was talking about the architect moment, because you have like action leading up to it.
Yeah.
And yes, Trinity supposedly in danger, you know, and you've already seen the flash forward, so you know she's going to get shot.
You know what's going to happen, yeah.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Neo is just standing in a room while a guy talks at him.
Right. But that is still my favorite scene. I keep coming back to that.
Really?
Yeah. The architect scene. Since it's such an interesting conversation. And it shows so much about both the machines and sort of the man, this machine who can't understand why these humans just don't want to live in eternal bliss.
Yes.
And, you know, okay, fine, this oracle, this intuitive program or whatever, she whipped up the solution. And also the fact that this is a fun, you know, meta thing, but all of the architect is a white man. All of the agents are white men, and they represent in this matrix power. And so they have learned from humans, okay, how do we, you know, show that we are in power? Oh, we make ourselves white men. So yeah, that shows like how they, you know, the bad stuff they learned from us as well, or how to put it.
Right. Well, and then the Oracle, of course, this rogue program is
right.
A black woman.
Is a black woman, yeah. It shows how they study us, or study the humans in this shape.
Yeah, I mean, there is somewhat of an argument to be made that she's a bit of a magic Negro, as my friends in America refer to it, which is, you know, the kind of like the folksy elderly black person giving wisdom, which is, you know, a constant issue in Hollywood movies. But you're right, it is interesting at least that it is kind of setting up the power dynamic is that, yes, everybody in power is a white man. And here we have a black woman who is actually the one who not only knows the truth, you know, can sort of see the truth and what have you, but also is the only one who could solve the problem of the Matrix crashing because humans couldn't accept a perfect world.
Right. And also, this is some spoilers for the third movie, but she's the one who gets it right at the end. She's the one who, like, she is sort of the mastermind, you could say, behind what happens in the third movie, which I'm going to have to discuss slightly, because the third movie ends with peace. And what this movie does, it sets up where Neo starts understanding, especially in this architect scene, that he can't beat these machines and they can't beat the humans. And so he starts to think about that, and in the third movie he realizes, okay, the only way this is going to work is if we have peace.
There has to be coexistence, yeah.
Exactly, we can't live without each other. And yeah, she basically sets everything in motion, and then Neo comes through, and at the end there are a sort of a truce, at least.
Okay.
So this movie starts, because at the end of the first movie, he says to, you know, he makes the phone call and then he flies away. And what he tells them is basically, we, the humans, are going to beat you. I'm going to show them a world without you. And this movie represents him starting to understand that that can't happen. And then in the third movie, he commits to it.
Okay, so it's almost like Neo becoming sort of, you know, achieving enlightenment.
Yes. And they bang on that pretty heavily in the third movie.
Oh, do they? Okay.
About achieving enlightenment. He gets blinded and, you know, starts seeing with, you know, light vision and everything.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I really do probably need to see that then.
I think you should. I think you would appreciate, at least, you know, at a macro level, it has its good moments.
One thing I have to ask about that third movie is, like, do we get to see Zion get destroyed? Because I was really, like, they built up so much in this movie. The idea that, you know, that there was this immediate danger that the machines are drilling down and, you know, they have whole big political arguments and stuff about whether they should, you know, follow the crackpot religious people in the form of Morpheus or whether they should all, you know, follow orders and stand there to defend the base and blah, 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 and act like an army. And I naturally assumed that that was going to be the climax of the movie. And instead, the climax of the movie is somebody rolling up and saying, oh, yeah, Zion got destroyed. It was terrible. Everybody's dead.
Well, they didn't say Zion. They said that they had planned several ships to try to make a counterattack higher up. And then someone pulled an EMP trigger and all these ships got down and were destroyed. So Zion is still fine at the end of the second movie.
Oh, so I misunderstood. Okay.
Right, they just lost several ships. Yes, the third movie, and that's also one of the criticisms of the third movie, it's very much a war movie. They walk around in these, you know, big metal skeletal suits and start shooting. And yeah, so there's lots of mass battles in there.
Right, yes, I did see the very obvious foreshadowing of the mech suits.
Right,
in
yes.
The minute I saw that, I was like, well, that's going to be coming up again.
Oh, yes. So, yeah, there are those against these squids. And they do that very well because the third movie, there are a few scenes in The Matrix, but there's not a lot of stuff happening in The Matrix. It's very much things happening in the real world.
Oh, okay.
Which is another criticism because the real world is not that hugely interesting, some people think.
Well, and also, you know, the movie is called The Matrix, or the series at least.
Yes, exactly.
So, yes, I can understand that would be criticism. Okay, well, you've certainly persuaded me that I need to see the third movie, if nothing else. But I don't know. I mean, what I really want to know then is, how do you sort of approach this movie? Bearing in mind that you watched it, obviously, after all three movies were out.
Yes.
So what is it about this movie in particular? Because it seems that that this is your favorite of the three, you're saying.
And oh,
what
yeah.
is it about this one that makes it your favorite compared to, you know, the action movie that is the first one and, as you said, the war movie that is the third one? What is it about this central movie that appeals to you?
First of all, I think the action sequences are much more interesting because it's less guns and more hand-to-hand. And I think that, you know, the first movie, the final one where they run around in this pillared gallery and start shooting and, well, none of them get hit, basically. You figure that out. No, the heroes are not going to get hit in a situation like that. And so there's more hand-to-hand combat in this, and I think that's more exciting when it comes to the action stuff. And then there is the world building and all the interesting people they keep adding in. They added in the French Merovingian, who is another favorite of mine, and also the Keymaker. The Keymaker is a relentless MacGuffin, but the scene when you meet him, you open up this door, and there are keys all over, like must be thousands of them. And he sits there, and he makes another key. He grabs that one, takes it with him. The characters are so realized. He walks around with these massive keychains, and he has a key for every occasion. And you see him using them. Oh, here, have one to start the motorbike. And then at the end, where he's shot, laid dying, he picks up the one key that hangs around his neck, and he hands it to Neo. You know, so many light touches as regards to characters and world building. And as I said, also the many interesting conversations.
I'm glad that you mentioned the Keymaker is a MacGuffin, because he really
he is. No.
It's like there's been no mention of this character whatsoever up until now. And then suddenly he's really important. And by the way, has a key for everything. I did like the bit with the key with the motorbike, however. That was.
Yeah, that's a fun
laugh.
Touch. This has a much lighter tone, and I like that as well than the first movie. you know, fitting the more superhero, superheroic, and the fact that they are now in power. In the first movie, it was run. You know, if you see an agent, if you get in trouble, you the best you can hope for is survival. And this movie, with Neo on their side, everyone is suddenly in power. And so they can stand and fight and win. And so there are different challenges facing them.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I don't know about lighter. I mean, you're right that it's lighter in the sense of the action stuff is a little more, not lighthearted, but as you say, you kind of know that they're going to win. You know, that's not really in doubt. Apart from the fact that the movie opens with
Trinity getting,
you know, a foreshadowing of Trinity being shot and killed. And the whole movie is kind of, well, everything actually in the movie, because, you know, Neo's decision in the architect's room is entirely based around the fact that he is convinced that he's, you know, that he's seen the future accurately, and that his vision of Trinity dying is true. And it turns out, of course, it is. You know, he was right. But yeah. So the entire movie hinges on that opening, which was a little bit surprising to me, I must admit, because I didn't realize we were seeing a flash forward at first. And I thought, wow, they've killed her off in the first, like, 30 seconds of the movie.
That's a brave move.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they had, you know, where he brings her back with a, you know, by pumping her heart. And I have to say, you know, that we see that in hundreds of Hollywood movies, like, okay, don't you die on me, I'm going to bring you back. And so, but I have to give them credit for actually being somewhat original in the way that he brought her back by actually squeezing her heart.
I was glad they did that, because when he removed the bullet, the minute he did that, I thought, well, if you can do that, surely you can bring her back to life. And then 5 minutes later, he did.
Yeah, exactly. And that he apologizes. I so like that. I'm sorry, because right before he brings her back, he says, you know, by all conventional laws, you are dead. No one, you know, except me can save you. And he also knows that he has these almost god powers at this point. And so he brings her back from the dead in a way that should not be possible and should not be done. He doesn't know what will happen. And so he apologizes to her before he does it, because he knows he's entirely selfish in doing so.
Well, and also doing something that, as you say, he's never done before, so he has no idea how it'll turn out.
Exactly. He doesn't know if she comes back, you know, without a soul or anything. So he just says he apologizes in advance. And yeah, I think that's a very nice touch, because he realizes what he can do and what can go wrong.
I think that was probably the only problem I sort of had with his godlike power, as you say, with this being effectively a Superman analog, was that he is godlike. And because it's the Matrix, we've seen, you know, he can see the code. He can effectively rewrite reality.
Right.
And okay, I understand that he's still learning how to use his powers, but then they still, you know, when he's in a box and he's, what do they say? He's like 5 miles north of their position or something. And yet it still takes him, he still has to physically fly, you know, through the space.
He can't teleport.
Right, rather than just appearing there. Or, you know, when they're being shot at by all the agents, it's like, well, just make the bullets stop. You did that before.
Yeah, that's true. I think at that point he realized that they were out of time. Because I think they were under some pretty big time constraints at that point. And so he just thought, okay, we need to get through this door now.
I guess.
But yeah, as you say. But otherwise, I think they did that very good, because when he was faced with all these, well, as they call them, vampires or werewolves or whatever they were in human shape, when they all start unloading their guns towards him, they could have made, you know, an extra 5 minutes of action there where he just jumps around and dodges. But he's completely businesslike there. He's like, no, I can stop these bullets, and so I'm going to.
That's true, actually, yes. You're right that they could have easily turned that into a full 10-minute action sequence by itself.
Just dodging the bullets. But he's like, no, get these out of here. That's ridiculous. One thing I also, as a side character, I like with this, I did like Bane. I think he's extremely scary. The Mr. Smith analog in the real world, who was apparently cast for his similarity with Hugo Weaving.
Oh, right. Yeah, but that was actually a bit... I didn't recognize him at first at the end, because you barely, he's not even that big a character at the start of the movie. You know, he's not that important. Okay, you see that he gets taken over by Smith, fair enough, you know, that's, and you think, oh, okay, well, that's going to be important again. But then in the by the time you see him again in the final scene and he's revealed to be the only survivor, you haven't seen him on screen for an hour.
No, that's true.
And he's upside down.
That's true. I think you're supposed to puzzle it together, seeing as they know that they were betrayed. But I can tell you that I didn't realize that at first. I remember my dad going like, aha, and I was like, who was that? That's the traitor. Oh, right. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you're right that they set it up that somebody clearly has betrayed them by sending off the EMP early. But with all the politics that we saw earlier,
it could be anyone.
Yeah. Right, there are probably half a dozen potential candidates for that role of traitor.
That's very true. That's very true. One thing I like with this is that Morpheus, who's this religious zealot, you know, not popular with the rulers, popular with the people, he's essentially John the Baptist in this Jesus analog. Which they pound on pretty heavily when Neo comes to Zion. You know, people come up to him and say, oh, you saved me. No, you saved yourselves. And I like that for once in this whole prophecy, chosen one, no. You know, you were wrong.
Right.
Because in every movie, it's like, you know, we have the fight against the establishment, who are narrow-minded and, you know, they need to trust in this old prophecy, the chosen one, and in the end, the chosen one is correct and saves them all. And this movie, it's no, that doesn't happen. And I think that's an interesting choice, and the way that this, of course, breaks Morpheus, who has built his life around finding the chosen one, and then that's not true. That was a big, fat lie.
Well, I mean, it's not entirely untrue, but because, you know, Neo does exist and, you know, that was a big part of it. But yes, the idea that taking the, what is the philosophy, prophecy that taking the one to see to the source
would stop the war.
Right. Just stops, should instantly stop the war. And, you know, as Neo says, he's not entirely wrong. It's just that the war will stop because the Matrix will crash, killing everyone. So, you know, it's one of those be careful what you wish for scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, they set all that up so that Neo was supposed to go through the other door, allowing Zion to be destroyed, but the Matrix to survive.
Yes, and pick his 23 disciples to repopulate Zion, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, with regards to the Jesus analogy, I was almost expecting him to suddenly, like when the poor and the needy came up offering him gifts and asking him to, you know, like, I half expected him to basically be curing the lame and maybe like, you know, washing a beggar's feet or something.
Yeah, that's what they set up in that scene, yeah. So you have Jesus and then you have Mr. Smith, who goes in a very different direction. He becomes almost like a comic book villain. He starts having all of these one-liners everywhere that he did not have in the first movie.
Yeah, it is a really strange progression for his character, isn't it?
Yeah, he sort of goes insane. Me, 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 me too. And so forth. I love him as an actor. And I hope that one day he will get in a big Hollywood production, he will get to play a human who can, you know, use facial expressions. Because he plays here where he's a program. He plays in The Lord of the Rings where he's supposed to be an impassive elf. He plays in, he plays in V for Vendetta where he wears a mask.
Yeah.
And so forth. So, yeah, maybe one day.
He's really good in Priscilla, though.
Yeah. Yeah, and he has an excellent voice. I mean, I love him in this movie. He's a very good counter to Neo in that way.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I mean, he is a great actor, Hugo Weaving. I have to assume that he would just had a whole barrel of fun making these movies. I mean, even the first one, but especially this one, because as you say, his entire thing is to sort of smirk at Neo and deliver one-liners. That's kind of all he does in this movie, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they basically set him up to the third movie, where he, you know, has copied everyone in the Matrix, and made it his own domain.
Right, right. And yeah, I mean, that's not Hugo Weaving, obviously, doing all the sort of, you know, the kung fu stuff in those.
He does apparently a surprisingly amount of them.
Really?
Yeah, they all trained with the, I can't remember his name, but they had a big famous choreographer for all of these movies. And apparently he went on record as saying that he was not super coordinated, so he basically always threw right punches or something. So I tried to look at, apparently he did, you know, a bit. I guess they all had stunt people to a bigger or lesser extent, but it seems like he did some of it at least.
Oh, okay. I mean, I knew that they'd all trained, and obviously Keanu famously does a lot of his own, you know, kung fu and wire work in these movies. And I gather Carrie-Anne Moss did as well. But, you know, they also have age on their side compared to Hugo Weaving, you know, who is, I believe, you know, quite older than Keanu.
That's true, yeah.
You know, although I'm saying that, then again, Keanu's got that thing where...
He is eternally young.
Yeah, good genes. Actually, no, I'm looking at it. Keanu's only 4 years younger than Hugo Weaving. Good Lord.
Yeah, and I mean, as you said, they adapted the fighting style. Like, he throws these big, heavy punches in the way, you know, where Keanu and Carrie-Anne Moss jumps around a lot more.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I mean, Keanu's pretty much, ever since Speed, really, has kind of made his entire career being able to do kung fu, hasn't he? So
yeah, that's true. I think that's also a part of the big success for these movies, but you would be able to speak better than that to me. But when Matrix came out, was that the first big successful kung fu movie in this way that had these kind of fights?
That's an interesting question, actually. I don't think it was the first, because I'm pretty sure... Oh, actually, no, I was going to say Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, but no, that was released after The Matrix.
Right, and those movies, like Hero and Crouching Tiger, they came to their prominence, I think, a bit later, and when they came out during this time, they were a bit, you know, you would not see them at prime time in cinemas in the same way that you could see Matrix.
Well, I don't know. Crouching Tiger was actually in the UK. Anyway, again, I can only speak to the UK, but in the UK, Crouching Tiger was a huge release.
Oh, right.
That was a proper, you know, like multi-screen, lots of publicity, you know, everybody was
raving about,
Oh, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we're going to go and see Crouching Tiger. But yeah, as I say, now that I look at it, actually, I was wrong. And Crouching Tiger was released 2 years after the first Matrix. So maybe it was. I mean...
Maybe not the first, but one of the first really this big?
Right, the first big breaker. That's what I was going to say. Obviously, there have been kung fu movies, of course. And even, you know, even here in the UK, you know, we were familiar, or some of us were familiar with, like, Hong Kong sort of low-budget action cinema and stuff
right.
like that. You know, we'd seen Hard Boiled or whatever. But actually, yeah, maybe this was the first really... as you say, like big breakout, massive success movie that had, you know, since the days of Enter the Dragon, which, you know, is a whole two generations previous. So
right.
in terms of this sort of that generation, yeah, maybe it was the first big movie to kind of, to really present that. And of course now you can barely have an action movie without some kind of martial arts in it somewhere.
Yeah, which I like. As I said, I prefer that to guns, because guns never hit the heroes.
That's true, yes.
Unless, you know, unless it's in the leg or in the shoulder where it does absolutely no damage. Fight seems like there the antagonist can actually land some blows.
That's, yeah, true. Well, and also it's, I think part of it is also we still have a very... strong desire, I think, as moviegoers to see the actors doing physical stuff.
Right,
like,
yes.
In the action genre, obviously, you know, within this genre of, you know, this subset of movies, it's why the James Bond movies were, for years, renowned and famous for their ridiculous stunts. Now, a lot of those were stuntmen rather than the actors doing their own stunts, but nevertheless, because this was the days before... CGI,
yeah.
You know, when you saw a stunt of somebody in a, you know, what jumping out of a helicopter, like with right. a pair of skis strapped to their feet and parachuting down the side of a mountain or whatever. That was a real person doing that. That actually, somebody actually did that thing, you know, because there was no other way of achieving that effect. And I think now, because it is so easy to do stuff in CGI, especially in, you know, more recent years, I think there is still a very, very strong desire on the part of movie makers to, sorry, and movie audiences to not see that and to watch stuff where they know it has to be, you know, that is the real person. Okay, they might be on a wire. Of course, they're pulling their punches and it's like choreographed, but nevertheless, you're watching the actor actually do something physical. And so the Kung Fu Matrix style aesthetic really supports that.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember like, when my parents were arguing against me seeing my dad, who had seen them, of course, argued, you know, it's the fights are, you know, they're mostly ballet, which I thought was a good way of explaining, you know, choreographed fight. But you don't care because it's the way it looks that matters, really.
Right. When you watch an actual ballet, you don't complain that everybody's rehearsed.
Right. They're choreographed
100
exactly.
times and done it before.
Yeah. It's the performance, really.
Yeah. I think that's the thing when you, because I was struck in this movie that the, by how much more Kung Fu there was compared to Bullets, as you said, but also that the fights in this did feel a lot more like watching a choreographed ballet. You know, they were less visceral. And much more about let's spend 5 minutes having this really elaborate fight scene where we'll do lots of funky moves and it'll look amazing, which didn't have, for me, have the same impact as the fights in the first movie had. But I did admire them on a purely technical level because, yeah, those must have taken, I mean, you can imagine, like, you know, just the fight scene between Neo and the Oracle's Guardian alone, you know,
right,
when they're jumping
yes.
up and down on the tables, that probably took a week to film.
Yeah.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
I think the whole Burly Bra scene took a month or something.
Wow.
So yeah, it's amazing. But then again, comes back to the fights in the first one. They were always, you know, with a tinge of desperation. And it's the same. In here, they couldn't really do that because Neo was all-powerful. And so they committed to that, which is,
yeah.
again, what I really like about this. They commit to the fact that they have an overpowered hero. And so, okay, with him, we can't do this desperate, scrappy, down-to-the-wire fights. We go in the other direction instead and make them, you know, even more artsy and fancy.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually, because one of the other things I noticed, and I'm sure this must have been deliberate, was that none of the three main heroes, Neo, Trinity, Morpheus, none of them ever break a sweat when they're fighting inside the Matrix.
Right.
Like, they literally do not ever break a sweat, get out of breath. There's no, as you say, there's no desperation. And I can't remember if that's the case in the first movie as well. Or not?
Well, in the first movie, well, there is some desperation in this, partly when you have Morpheus fighting the guy up on the back of the truck. You get the sense that, okay, he's in big trouble right now, and the same with Trinity in the final scene where she gets shot. But still, yeah, they look a lot more detached than they did in the first.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean also with this film having a lighter tone. It's because of exactly that. They don't break a sweat. They are more in power in this movie because re-watching the first Matrix after watching this, you realize that the first one has such, it's dark, it is horrible. You know, it's horrible nearly all the time in the first Matrix movie. It's a giant struggle, you know, every single second. And in this one, there isn't, because they have finally gotten themselves in power and gotten some breathing room.
Right, right. Yeah, I think I might need to go back and rewatch the first, because I haven't seen the first one now in a long time. I might have to go back and rewatch it just to make that comparison.
Yeah, if you do, I think you will see the big sort of tone difference in these. When you see them back to back, you're like, oh, really? Wow.
Oh, man. Yeah, I must admit, I was, we did Jupiter Ascending.
Yes.
On this show last year. I did that with Serenity Caldwell. And I really, really liked Jupiter Ascending.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
but it wasn't very well received. And, you know, they had plans to make a series of movies, and that apparently has fallen through. And I must admit, watching this, I was thinking, maybe that's a blessing in disguise. because not that this is a bad movie per se, but it is so different to the first one that it makes me worry that all the things I liked about Jupiter Ascending, if they made a sequel, all those things wouldn't be in the sequel.
No, it would be a very different movie, because the same thing there in the end of Jupiter Ascending, she is also very much in power.
Suddenly she's royalty. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so it would have, if they made a second Jupiter Ascending, it would be politics. You know, yeah. It would be a, a hostile takeover.
Because she owns the Earth by the end of the movie.
Yeah, and lots of other planets as well. Like, she was the heir to this guy, you know, to hundreds of thousands of planets, it seemed like. And, you know, Earth was just a personal touch. So, yeah, it would be, she would have to defend it against a hostile takeover or something. If they went with the same tonal shift they did, you know, from Matrix to Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah. Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, well, I like that they were able to see, okay, which way could this story go? Because even those who doesn't like the sequels, I think most of them agree that, yes, if you had to make a sequel, you would have to take the story in this direction, in the overarching story.
Right, unless, as you said before, unless you hit a giant reset button, which
yes.
I think it is, you know, even if you don't like this movie, I think you have to appreciate that it was the braver move.
Yes, to move forward.
Right, to do these movies and progress, exactly, rather than revert back to, oh no, Neo's lost all his powers, here we go again.
Yeah, exactly. Fixed bug where the chosen one could stop bullets or whatever.
Yeah.
that's part of the reason why I admire this movie so much, because it's a really brave move when you look at every other Hollywood sequel there is, which is basically often, or very often, a rehash of the first movie. Here they actually said, no, if we're going to go through this, we need to make it completely different.
Yeah, well, and that is very commendable. So I think that's probably a good place to bring this to a close and say, Philip, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about this. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say about simulated computer hallucinogenic worlds?
Well, the best way is to check out my Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Philip Sildean, my name.
Do you want to spell that for people?
F-I-L-I-P. Sellden.
Yeah, I was going to say, what about the accent? But of course, you don't get that on.
No, you don't get it in Twitter, sadly.
Don't get it on the world. Well, you don't get it on the web, really. You don't get it in URLs either, do you?
No, or in email addresses as well.
Yeah. See, this is what happens when everything's designed by English speakers. Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my other work, including comics, books, music, and more, at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find more information about all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up, and just check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. And finally, the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is true for The Matrix as well, but this movie has an incredibly diverse cast when you look at mainstream Hollywood movies.
Yes.
And I think that's really, really good.
Yeah, the Wachowskis have always been really good about that, actually. I think.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, yes, okay, Keanu is still, you know, a white man.
But yeah.
Like, almost everyone else
is not. Yeah, except for the bad guys.
Oh, as you said, yes, they're all, like, you know,
they're all white men. Yeah, it was fun. I read up on the first movie, there's a character who's called Switch. Who was supposed to, she's played by a woman who apparently only auditioned for half of the role because it was supposed to be that she was a woman in the Matrix and a man outside of the Matrix.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And somehow that fell through. But I think that would have been a really fun thing. But she's, you know, dressed very androgynously. How do you pronounce that?
Androgynously, yes.
Androgynously, yeah. Oh, pronunciation is hard.
English, yeah. But that's fascinating because of course, both of the Wachowskis.
Yeah, exactly.
Being trans women. Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Lana and Lily, yeah. So clearly they wanted to do something like that. And for some reason, I didn't, you know, I wasn't able to uncover why that fell through. But that would have been great. Because I don't think many people would have caught it either, because there are so many characters at the beginning of The Matrix.
Right, but even so, I have to... I mean, yeah, as you say, you know, we don't know for sure, but speculating, I would be willing to confidently speculate that that was probably, you know, a decision that was taken out of their hands. That somebody went, that's just too far, too weird.
You know, we're already funding this extremely weird movie.
Well, in 1999, right, yeah, this was a very weird movie to spend a lot of money on, the first Matrix, obviously. You know, a very, very odd, unusual movie, and it did cost a lot of money. And also, frankly, you know, the issue of trans people just wasn't on the radar.
God, no.
You know, it really wasn't a thing like it is now. You know, to our detriment, but it just in 1999, that was not something that was... talked about
at
really,
all
in mainstream society at all. Yeah,
no, today it's, you know, has started, but it's still very, very light.
Oh yeah, I mean we're still only making, you know, very small steps, but at least now we are talking about it.
Yeah,
you know, in the well, I mean, there you go, I was just looking up, it's only 5 years after Ace Ventura, which, you know, famously the entire plot hangs around effectively transphobia.
Right.
That's, you know, so yeah, we still have a long way to go now, but we've come a long way since 1999, I think. The 23 thing has to be a reference to
something, yeah.
Well, it's to the Illuminati trilogy.
Oh.
And the Fnords, where 23 is a mystical significant number. But that is such an obscure reference.
Yeah, I did not get that.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, how many people are actually going to get that? That's really... I mean, it doesn't matter, because if you don't know, it's just an arbitrary number. But yeah, I was like, wow. Because there are no other real... references to that throughout the first or this movie that I can recall, and yet suddenly there's an Illuminati reference. And it's, again, if you haven't read it, you won't know this, but when people are Illuminati fans, they tend to put references to it in a lot of things, like, you know, tend to sprinkle them around. So to just get one near the end of a movie all by itself is just really strange. But it's the only thing I can think of that, because it's not like there were 23 apostles or anything, so it's the only thing I can think of that it must be a reference to. Very odd. I was actually surprised that she survived this movie. I really thought they were going to kill her off in this movie, and when we got to the end and she's still alive, I was like, oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, they do their relationship. I completely buy in the third movie in a way that I... not really have time to do in this one, I feel like.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to watch that now. Yeah,
yeah. But the third one is riddled with plot holes, unfortunately.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Despite it being them being produced at the same time, it's still, yeah.
Yeah, they did a Lord of the Rings style thing, didn't they, where they filmed both of them at once.
Yeah, exactly. And they originally was, I think their plan was to release them like weeks.
Oh, wow.
Away, yeah. And they turned it into 6 months again, I assume, out of their hands to really have to sort of a part one and then part two, you know, a couple of weeks later.
Yeah, that's a really, I always found that a really odd decision. Like if they had released them, you know, within a month of one another, that would have made sense. Or indeed, if they'd waited 18 months, you know, as you would between normal movies, that would also make sense. But 6 months is a really strange...
I think, yeah, that must have been sort of the compromise.
Yeah, I guess. But I by that point, I would have thought it'd be better to wait a full year, you know, and build up the anticipation. But I don't know.
It was The Matrix and Terminator, who everyone was talking about and who I was not allowed to see.
Wow, wait, people were still talking about The Terminator when you were in school.
Oh, that's
a really old movie.
My kids. No, yeah. The second and the third was in the mix as well. But yeah, people were talking about, especially the eye scene where he scrapes away an eye.
Right.
And, you know, being, God, what was I, 11, 12, something, going to my parents and asking to see Matrix and Terminator. And, you know, it was the situation where every other kid had seen it, and my parent going, every other parent must be crazy. Right. And so, but yeah.
Hey, Mom and Dad, can I watch that movie where the guy scoops his own eye out?
My dad struck a deal with me when he finally let me watch these movies. When we watched The Terminator, he would fast forward through the scenes where the Terminator just goes up and kills two people for no reason. Or, you know, he visited, I think, her friends and basically just kills them.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, you know, I won't show you that because that's needless murder. So,
wow.
No, I'm fine with that. I mean, I'm glad that they forced me to wait because I felt dizzy after watching The Matrix, especially the scene when he woke up and, you know, vomits out cables. I think you have to be a certain age not to be permanently scarred by that.
If you'll forgive me the stereotyping, I was going to say how very Scandinavian of your father.